Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of Crazy Money. How you doing today? Hope you're great. Today's a great day to be alive, but you knew that. Keep going. Keep doing your thing. Keep moving forward. Running, walking, thinking, writing, cooking, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. A couple of weeks ago, my buddy Beno Ansley, residential real estate magnate of Atlanta, Georgia, called me and he said, "Hey, Paul, I got a couple you should meet." I said, "Well, tell me about them, Beno. Who is this couple that should be on the Crazy Money podcast?" He goes, "Well, Wade Shealy is this guy I know from the real estate world. He's developed over $3 billion in resort real estate over the last few decades, including Hampton Island, Georgia, whose residents include Ben Affleck, Jennifer Lopez, and Robert and Lydia Mondavi. And he's the CEO of a company called ThirdHome.com. But even better than that, his partner is Debbie Fields." I said, "Well, who's Debbie Fields?" He goes, "Have you ever heard of the Mrs. Fields cookie empire?" I was like, "That Debbie Fields? That Mrs. Fields?" He's like, "Yeah, they're a couple. They live in Nashville, Tennessee. Sometimes they live in Aspen. And I think you should have them on your podcast." Well, gosh dang it, I sure did want to. Debbie Fields founded the Mrs. Fields cookie brand when she was in her early 20s in Palo Alto, California. And she built it into a global empire. Wade Shealy got his start selling Bibles door-to-door for the Southwestern Publishing Company, a company with whom I interviewed in college. I can't remember if it was knives or books. I was encyclopedias or something. I was supposed to be doing door-to-door. It's 100% commission type of arrangement. And I remember that interview going like, this sounds very, very hard. Well, Wade did it. And Wade was so good at it that he became a regional sales manager, building his team up to hundreds of people selling Bibles door-to-door. His stories, as he relays them in this podcast episode, are really interesting. He talks about the power of positive thinking. And that's not just some Norman Vincent Peale trope, ladies and gentlemen. He's really saying that we're in control of our thoughts, that we have the opportunity to decide to be successful. Not that it's easy, but that on a daily basis, if we wake up, we sing ourselves a song, if we read something motivational, that we will accomplish more than we thought possible. Similarly, Debbie was a nobody, her words, just some young woman driving a VW Bug and was working as a ball girl for the Oakland A's, one of the first of that genre. And she decided she wanted to start making cookies, not just any cookies, super high quality cookies with lots and lots of butter, sugar, and other high quality ingredients, unlike the crispy, stale-tasting Chips Ahoy that were the norm. That was the standard for cookie before Debbie Fields got into the cookie business. And she talks about her commitment to quality in the face of accountants staring her down, talking about margin and how it led to success. But more importantly, that it was part of the values that she brought to her company and that high quality is something that she embraces in everything she does. This is a very interesting couple. I was very pleased to meet them. Please enjoy this conversation with Wade Shealy and Debbie Fields.
Debbie had gone on a private yacht with some people in Tahiti. And one of my members that I'd only met one time years and years ago, maybe 8 years ago, decided she was going to try and set Debbie up with me because they were on this yacht together.
Tall, handsome guy, successful, excellent hair. That sounds like a good description.
So we never got introduced. We never met or anything. And a couple of years later, Debbie came from Aspen, where she lives, to Nashville. And so the night before, I got a phone call from a lady I knew here in Nashville. And she had a cupcake company that she had about 300
GG's
cupcakes. And so the cupcake lady wanted to introduce me to the cookie lady. And so she said, "What are you doing tomorrow night?" And I said, "I don't have any plans." She said, "Well, why won't you come have dinner with a girlfriend of mine?" And I said, "Okay, I'd be glad to meet her." And she said, "Well, it's a little more complicated than that. I actually invite two single girls to meet you at the same time." So I said, "Well, I've never done that before, but how's that work?" And she said, "Well, I'm going to put you in the middle and put one on one side and one on the other." And so I went, and Debbie was about an hour and a half late showing up. So I talked to the other girl first, and then Debbie arrived, and I never talked to the other girls after that once Debbie got there. And that was almost 5 years ago. And we've been together ever since. So the cupcake lady introduced me to the cookie lady.
That sounds like the strategy our realtor used when we bought this house that I now live in and I'm just about to sell. But she showed us a pretty good house first. But then she showed us the house. She knew we'd buy second. And she was like, once you see the first one, you're going to see the second one. You'd be like, I'm going to take the second showcase.
Yes.
So that's a good realtor, because that's what we always train people, our realtors, to do, is set them up with something they're not going to like, so the next one looks really good. When they
Right. So, yeah. And how long did you date, and how long have you been married?
We've been together almost 5 years. Yes. We're not married, but we are.
Oh, I apologies.
That's all right. We both have been married, and we've had all our kids. And so we're like, you know, what's the purpose of that? And so we just life partners together and go back and forth between Nashville and Aspen and travel and have a great life together.
Sounds fantastic. All right. So you've both got really interesting stories as entrepreneurs and human beings. And I'll come to you second, Wade.
Well, that's the way it always works.
Well, you know, Debbie's got the big consumer brand name. So the literal brand name. So let's start with her. Debbie, it's 1977. Jimmy Carter was president. The number one song in the country is Rod Stewart's Tonight's the Night. And the best picture was, guess what the best picture was in 1977? Do you remember?
Ooh, no.
It was a boxing movie. Rocky, it was Rocky, was the number one movie.
Oh, I was not going there. Okay.
What were you up to and what happened over the next few years?
What a great question.
Thank you.
In 1977, I made the decision to do the impossible. And that was to take a dream of mine, something that gave me incredible pleasure, and go into the cookie business. I opened my first store in California, in Palo Alto, in August of 1977, with literally no, I was 20 years old, no business experience, no pedigree. I had nothing that you were supposed to have in order to create a business platform. So when I talk about no money, zero. The only thing I owned was a Volkswagen Bug. And
what color was it?
Orange, bright orange.
Of course.
With a sunroof.
Yes, nice.
And I had this recipe. I had this dream. I had not finished college and I had no business experience. But what I did have was a desire to set out and do something that I already knew was impossible, but I was guided by I'm possible. Same word, but a whole different perspective. And trying to get financing in 1977, do you remember what the prime rates were?
19%, something like that.
Well, you are absolutely double digits. I got my loan at $25,000 at 21% prime. Now,
was it a payday lender?
Now, once again, but here's what I'm trying to translate. Even under the most challenging obstacles, I still made it work. So yes, 21% was ridiculous, but it was the only money I could access. And so either I launch my dream, I make things happen, you take the impossibility, you make it a possibility. So that is what I did in 1977, opening my very first store and actually discovering instant failure. I opened my store and I had no customers. And I was trying to bring a fresh, warm, hot, soft and chewy cookie to market when the competition was my bakery literally next door that was selling chocolate chip cookies for 9 cents. But they were cold. They were made with ingredients that were not pure, like butter and lots of chocolate. And so customers did not understand what made me different. And when I opened up my first day and nobody was making any purchases, I knew I was going out of business and I was failing fast. And so the strategy was I had to find a way to literally fail my way to success. And that caused me to literally stop what I was doing, place cookies on a cookie sheet, leave the store, and desperately find people to try my cookies. I did find some people who stopped, tried, and they did follow me back to my store. And that resulted in sales that day that literally it was such a game changer, because I learned the try and buy method. And that was simply the more I gave away, the more sales I generated. And that really became like a platform for me, the sampling and literally allowing people to try it before they made their decision, because they weren't making a decision on cost. They were making a decision on pleasure. And I didn't have to tell them anything other than, do you love it? And if they loved it, I didn't have to sell it.
Because what you were introducing was new. People didn't know about premium baked goods like we do today. We expect everything today is, you know, a crumble cookie that's 4 pounds each and, you know, has all these exotic ingredients. But your competition back then was like a Chips Ahoy, right?
It was. In fact, the cookies that were, Mrs. Fields was the first company in America to introduce the soft and chewy cookie. Mm. There's methodology as to the reasoning behind it, but it simply had to do with the cookies that were on the market were dry, crunchy, and about the size of a quarter.
Right.
Mrs. Fields cookies were, you know, 3 inches. And my whole mission was, if somebody's going to have an experience, and this is really important in business for anybody that says, I want to create a product or service, well, you got to make sure it's market differentiable, which is, why should your product or service exist? Is it like no other? And for me, when I was growing up, my dad was a welder. I am the youngest of 5 girls. My mom was working very hard to make every dollar stretch. And that resulted in literally our having margarine, and everything was imitation. And so when I made cookies as a teenager, I was making cookies thinking they were great. And then I got my first job working for the Oakland A's. And
she was the first ball girl in Major League Baseball.
That's fantastic.
Oakland A's. Curly Finley said, put her in a little skirt and have her run around the ball field.
Oh, it was my skill sets.
Yeah, right.
And what did you learn from that? What were the skills that you, what got you the job, and what did you take away from that that helped you succeed?
Well, luck got me the job. I lined up with hundreds of other girls, and I just, you know, you never know what's going to happen, but literally like with Cinderella and a shoe, one moment in your life can really change to give you opportunities that you never dreamed of. And for me, I went through the interview and I was just me. I love interfacing with people. I love talking and I love connecting. And so what I learned working for the Oakland A's is to learn to be around famous people and to have the fans on one side and then these amazing sports figures on another side and see how they could relate to actually their fan base. I think the biggest impact I learned working for the Oakland A's was watching the players after the game, because my mom and dad would come to, somebody would come pick me up. And basically we only had one car, a family of 7 with one car. And sometimes I'd wait hours for somebody to come grab me. Well, I would watch players leave the stadium and there would always be a fan base and kids waiting to have an autograph. And I would watch those players. They were all famous. They were all accomplishment, but they were consistent. There were those that were so kind and would stop and sign their mitts, whatever. And it was so transforming to see how the impact that that famous person had on a child. And then there were others that were so powerful, so busy, and they never took the time to stop. And I would watch.
You're talking about Reggie Jackson, right?
I'm not going to name names. And I'm just going to say, to watch those same kids smiling from ear to ear and then a moment later, like begging and kind of like asking, pleading with a player to stop, and they didn't. And to see kind of like this transformation, what I walked away with is everyone, every one of us, every day, every moment deserves to feel like you are the most important thing I will ever come in contact. And if that is really how it was such a game changer for me about the importance of making people feel important. And you know what? What that cost is that I'm in the business. Mrs. Fields was created on the basis of, yes, we sell cookies, but we're not in the cookie business. We're in the feel-good feeling business. Mm-hmm. Our job is to sell an experience. Our job is to create a smile. Our job is to literally give something from our heart and make people just feel so much better. And so that was that's my oxygen. I mean, like, that's what I love to do.
I want to read something I read about your company and the experience or sort of the time and place you were starting this company or growing the company. And this is from the digital publication Eater. It says, Debbie Field's working mom persona made the brand stand out. She, just as much as her cookies, conveyed the enticing idea or wholesome memory of a caring mother's quest to create the best of her family. Her image as a successful businesswoman straddled the period's blurring line between traditional feminine expectations and the growing class of American working women.
Wow, I never heard that.
No? What do you think? Does that make sense to you? Is that an accurate...
It gives me goosebumps. It really gives me goosebumps because you have to understand that I knew what I was up against when I was trying to launch Mrs. Fields. When you don't have a pedigree, when you don't have the money, and you don't have anything that really makes sense, you have to set yourself up and say, you know what, I am different. And I believe that what people were looking for was what I was looking for. Because I felt like I was insignificant. And I didn't have, if I drove up in a Volkswagen Bug or if I just didn't have the right clothes, you know, it's easy to be dismissed. So for me, I wanted, when I bought something because I didn't have much money, I wanted it to be so good. And for me, building the cookie literally was putting in so much butter that the cookies would turn into pancakes, or putting in so much chocolate that the chocolate chips wouldn't fit. Why did I do that? Because I wanted to not only guarantee my cookies, but I wanted to absolutely, from my heart, give the very best. And I set my standards so high that even, I know this sounds crazy, even the flaws were considered excellent. Like, I set a standard and said every cookie that's not sold within 2 hours has to become a cookie orphan. Well, the cookie didn't self-destruct.
Right.
It was because I knew that it's easy to compromise. So if you set your standards so high and somebody still makes a mistake, it's still great. That's the area I wanted to play in. And so I also thought in terms of competition, I needed to create a product that was so good that if anybody wanted to compete with me, they had to equally match me. They couldn't add more chocolate. They couldn't add more butter. There was nothing more pure. They couldn't bake it fresher or faster. I mean, I was committed to every factor of perfection. And then the other element that was really critical is the people I surrounded myself with. And I never wanted to write a customer service manual because that just takes time out of a day. It has to come from your heart. And so for me, I taught philosophy. Like, what is our purpose? What's our reason for existing in this business? And that was, number one, you got to have the very best, highest quality product 24/7, because we have to make our reputation every moment. When you are baking all day from scratch, every moment matters. And you never take that for granted. The second factor is that we had to really focus on philosophy. Like, we just said, we have to have the highest quality, no compromise, because I'd go crazy if there was a problem with quality. And the second thing is that we were there to focus on one register, and that was never the cash register. It was this register. If we could create a smile, we knew that the money would flow to the cash register. That's all I cared about, is highest quality and make our customers feel so good, because you're selling an experience and a feel-good product. So that was really just the essence and the basis of Mrs. Fields.
Hello, friends. This is Paul. We'll be right back with Wade and Debbie. But first, I want to tell you a few things. Number one, if you like Crazy Money, I sure would appreciate it if you would rate and review this show on the app that you're using to listen to it. Speaking of which, if you're not following it, please hit follow and follow this show so that new episodes are automatically loaded to your device. Secondly, I want you to subscribe to my Substack, wherein you will get writing from me periodically. It was every 10 days or so until the beginning of this year, when we were selling two houses and buying one in New York City for the relocation that is going to happen this summer. But it will increase in frequency, and I want you to be a part of it. There are links to both rating and reviewing and registering for my Substack in the show notes, And lastly, if you want to see me live telling jokes, there is a list of these shows coming up that you can link to in the show notes as well. But here they are, May 3rd and 4th. I'll be headlining the Denver Comedy Lounge in Denver. Sunday, May 5th, I will be at the Boulder Comedy Show in Boulder, CO. May 17th at the Cary Theater in Cary, North Carolina. May 18th, Greensboro, North Carolina at the Idiot Box. Those shows will be with my friend Paul Farivar, Two Pauls, One Show. May 24th through 26th at the Vail Comedy Festival in Vail, Colorado. That'll be a fun one. And then we're doing a Florida run, guys. Paul and I doing the Two Pauls, One Show thing. It's Side Splitters, June 19th in Tampa, Florida. June 20th at Off the Hook Comedy Club. I'm featuring for Paul at the Vero Beach Comedy Zone, Friday, June 21st and 22nd. And then the 23rd, we are at McCurdy's Comedy Club in Sarasota. Y'all come out. Why don't you? Links in the show notes. Thank you. Did you have bankers or accountants that said, yeah, Debbie, sure, but we have no margin in these cookies because you put so much butter and so much chocolate into them?
Let me tell you, the bankers were so intriguing to me because I started the business. And my husband, who had his fledgling business, closed his business and actually joined mine. And the bankers would, when we would go and ask for more financing, more money, because I wanted to open more stores, the first thing, and I just kind of smiled and laughed at it. The first thing that they would say is, you know, we're going to have to get life insurance on Randy. And I'm like, he doesn't even know the recipe, but that's fine.
Right. Different time.
The second thing was, it was actually my husband at the time that was like, I was constantly making, like when I would make my macadamia nut cookies, I was pouring in the macadamia nuts. And macadamias are like the most expensive nut. And I don't build a product to a price level. I build the product. I put in so many macadamia nuts because I'm not one of those. I don't want to do the hunt and peck and look for a macadamia nut. I want to just see them, you know, flourishing in the cookie. And I want a nut in every bite. So when I'm making my recipes and he'd come in the kitchen, he's like, back that up. And I'm like, get out of the kitchen. And right. I would take my product. Literally, I'd take the products I'd make. I would go to the store and I would just see if I could sell them at a higher price point. And sure enough, that is the way I kind of did field testing, is to take it directly to the market and see if customers will pay for an increased, you know, product cost. And sure enough, they did.
Wow. Wait, can you beat Ball Girl as an interesting job as a late teen, early adult? I'm just curious if you've got a better story than that.
Well, I never try to compete with Debbie because that's not a good idea. But I did have an interesting start. I came from a humble background as well, like Debbie did. Our house was not, I think they had 924 square feet. We may have had 1,000 square feet in our house.
Oh, big time. That's an extra 76 square feet.
Yeah. So I grew up in a small town, South Georgia, and was at school at the University of Georgia, majoring in landscape architecture. And my dad has said that we'll pay for your sister's college, but you're on your own. So you'll have to figure out your own way to pay your way through school. And so when I was at Georgia in Athens, I met a guy and he told me about selling Bibles and dictionaries door to door for a summer job. Well, I didn't think I was much of a salesman, but he didn't look like much of a salesman either. He told me how much money he'd made in the summer doing it. So I signed up to go do it. And we went to, came to Nashville, Tennessee, where the company was based. And we had that summer 7,300 college students selling books door to door for this same company that's been here since, for about 175 years in Nashville. And they sent me to New Hampshire and I didn't have a car. But I walked door to door working 100 hours a week, straight commission, making 30 demonstrations every day. I start at 7:59. I wouldn't stop knocking until 9:30. And usually worked till about 10 or 10:30 every night. And that's how I got started, was selling books door to door. And I came back and told my friends how much money I made. And they said, well, if you can do that, sign me up to go because, you know, I think I can do as well as you did. So I took 25 guys out the next summer and went to Oklahoma. And then they came back, took 75 guys out. Then they came back and took 150 guys. And so when I graduated from school, I had a couple hundred guys at Georgia in my organization, and that was my start in selling.
When somebody opens the door, assuming they open the door, after you knock on it, what do you say to them? How do you get the conversation started about buying Bibles?
A lot of the guys that I took out, a lot of the guys who did it would not make it because it is rejection.
I don't think I would have, man.
You know, I guess I was so used to rejection growing up that it didn't bother me. You know, in fact, Debbie hears me tell the story. I went to one house and the lady slammed the door in my face. And so I got my sample case. And I ran around to the back door of the same house and knocked on it. And the same lady came to that door. And when she answered the door before she could say anything, I said, "Ma'am, I sure hope you aren't as mean as the lady in the front of the house." and she started laughing. So, you know, you give thousands and thousands of presentations and people always said, you know, "How'd you get so good in sales?" And it's like anything. If you do something thousands and thousands of times and your livelihood, you know, the way to make money is based on it, you learn how to do it.
And are you asking questions to try to unearth their fears, hopes, and dreams? Like, how do you get on the conversational chain? Or
you learn real quick how to connect very fast with people. The way I did my first summer is I didn't have a car. And so I ran out of territory in the little town I was working. And so my sales manager said, "Well, you figure out how to work in another territory." So I figured out how to go out in the country. And it's pretty far between houses up there. So what I learned was I'd make a sale in one house and I'd ask the lady after she bought the books if she wouldn't mind driving me down to her neighbor's house.
Oh, wow. Great.
And so she would drive me down to her neighbor's house and I'd say, "Now, would you mind just sitting here and waiting for me to make sure she's home?" And so I go up to the door and knock on her friend's door. And then when her friend answered the door, I turn around and say, "Hey, Susie, thanks for bringing me down here. Good to see you. And I'll be delivering your books back at the end of the summer." And so that was my intro to her friend because her neighbor brought me down there. So that's the way I learned how to go from house to house was I'd have the neighbors all help me sell.
You got the implicit endorsement of the neighbor.
But, you know, Paul, even more so than learning how to sell, the biggest thing I learned was about myself. You know, because you do have to keep yourself motivated and you do have to keep a positive attitude. And I had all these little sayings, you know, some people find a way, some people find an excuse, form the habits of doing things unsuccessful people aren't willing to do.
Right.
You know, so I always read positive motivational books in the mornings. Og Mandino was my go-to book every morning to read something positive, motivational. I'd take a cold shower to wake myself up. I'd sing a little song in the mornings after breakfast to get myself going. And it sounds kind of crazy, but it is a lot about how you motivate yourself and get yourself going and the energy that you're able to have. And especially because, you know, everything in life is not easy, you know, and so a lot of it is controlling your own thoughts. And so that was the biggest thing I learned from selling books so many summers and trying to teach, you know, hundreds of other kids how to do it is you have to control your own thoughts. That's where it starts right here. Because if you don't control that, then going out, you know, it's not going to be easy.
100%. And so how do you make the transition into real estate?
A lot of the guys who did very well in the book business, and we have a lot of people here, Senator Marsha Blackburn, she sold books. Rick Perry from Texas sold books. A lot of these guys, very successful people, all work for the same book company. A lot of these guys had gone into real estate down in Hilton Head, South Carolina. I did go work for the company for a few years, training a lot of the kids and motivating the kids to do it after I graduated from college. But then I went to Hilton Head and got into selling resort real estate with a lot of the book guys down there who had success.
Was that late 70s, early 80s also?
1984.
So Hilton Head was cool, man. Hilton Head was like, that was peak period where Hilton Head was just booming, right?
Yeah, it had one stoplight and it was a good place to get started. I had a lot of friends down there. I didn't know anything about real estate, but quickly learned. And so I started my own company a couple of years after I left there or went there. Then from that company, I started doing development and started developing as well as running sales organizations that sell real estate. So I've been really doing resort real estate since 1984.
So real estate is high risk, high reward, or high risk, no reward, depending upon the year. What's the secret to staying in the game?
Well, you have to take risk. Debbie knows a story in 2002. I bought a 4,000 acre island off the coast of Georgia and convinced a guy for $19 million that I could buy it. I didn't have $19 million to buy it, but I figured if he gave me a little bit of time, I could figure it out. And during that time, I raised most of it, didn't have all of it. At the time, Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck were a hot commodity, and I'd sold them two houses at this island, even though I didn't own the island yet. They went ahead and closed on it, and I had to close the next day on it, and I was about $3.5 million short. And a real estate agent got me on the phone with somebody, and I talked to them for about 15 minutes, a banker, and they wired the $3.5 million in to help me close the deal. I was getting ready to lose the whole thing.
I need to close on an apartment in New York City. Can I get that guy's number? Because I'm about $3.5 million short.
I'm not sure they're still doing that now today with all the regulations and the government ruling on bankers. But, you know, you just have to take risk. I mean, I took a lot of risk on a lot of things I did. And, you know, I had the confidence, as Debbie and I've talked about before. I've always been willing to fail, but I had the confidence that I won't. That I'll figure out a way to make it happen somehow, some way. And I'm willing to do whatever it takes most of the time to make that happen. And so in anything, just like with Third Home, when I started Third Home, you got to take some risk, you know, but you also have to have the confidence that you can make it happen and the ability to create a vision that you can share a vision with other people that they buy into your vision. I wouldn't say that I'm that smart of a guy, but I always try to surround myself with other people that are a lot smarter.
Yeah.
I try to create the vision for everybody that gives them what's going to look like, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and that we're making a difference.
What year did you start Third Home?
So I started Third Home in 2010.
Which is in the depths of the real estate crash, right? I mean, there's blood in the streets at this point, right?
Yeah. And so that's really why I started, because I had been developing real estate and I had just sold a big project and gotten out of debt, thankfully. And so I decided not to go back into it because it didn't look like that was a good idea to be developing real estate in 2009 and 2010. And so
buying distressed assets, yes, but not developing new projects.
Yeah. And there wasn't a lot of money out there for development. And so I decided, you know, that's all I knew at that point was either selling books door to door, I did in college, or resort real estate. So I decided to stay in the resort real estate instead of going back selling books. And so I always felt like that there's an opportunity to create this platform like Third Home is, which, because over the years, Paul, what I saw is people would come to buy a second home in Hilton Head, for example. They would buy a home from me and they'd be so excited about buying this house in Sea Pines, for example.
Yeah.
But invariably, within 5 years, every one of them was back in our office wanting me to sell it. And I'd say to them, I'd say, well, I thought you really liked Sea Pines. They go, oh, we've loved it. It's been great. Our kids have loved it. We go to Harbor Town. We love the beach. But you know what? We're just kind of tired of coming to Hilton Head all the time. And we feel like, you know, owning a house here, we have to come here instead of paying rent to go somewhere else. So we're gonna sell this and buy somewhere else to go try a new place. And I thought, well, why can't we create a way that we can have all these people, these millions of second homeowners all over the world, instead of having to sell their home to go try somewhere new or occasionally go somewhere new, that they could actually create this pool that they could go use another club members or another second home in the club. And so that's how I started. I was in Atlanta and it was 2010 and I was sitting with Beno Ansley, who was a friend of mine that was in real estate in Atlanta, and a guy named Martin Sprock. And I told them about my idea. I didn't have a name for the company yet, but I said, here's my idea. And they said, well, let's go do it. Let's all throw in some money and you go start the club. And so I started with a couple houses and grew up from there. And now we've got about 18,000 homes in 100 countries, I think 2,500 different destinations around the world. And it's pretty much just grown organically, you know, where people use each other's on the platform. They use each other's homes.
What he is doing is so impressive to me. That it actually, I am an investor in his company and it's too good to be true. And what I love about what Wade is doing is that people are taking an asset like their second home and they are using that asset in a whole new dimension, which is they're taking their home to literally explore the world.
Yeah.
And that is a whole different mindset when you are thinking about, I've got this beautiful home. I love going there, but I want to explore the world with my family and my friends. And he has opened the door to making that happen.
That's really cool. We were talking a little bit earlier about the risks and rewards of real estate and how trustful it can be. Debbie, you had some ups and downs, and at a certain point, you had to give up control of your company. What did that feel like? What was that part of your career like?
Well, let's just start. I think that the way I approach life is I start and launch myself every morning when I wake up. If I'm breathing, I'm already way ahead of everybody else. I feel so activated, so excited.
What's your morning ritual? Do you have a ritual?
My morning ritual is just to wake up and know that I'm breathing and I'm like, I'm good for the day. I am back. When people ask me, how are you? I'm like, I am outstanding because I'm breathing.
Yeah.
It's good. Anything else, just bring it on. So I have this attitude that life is one of those things where don't be afraid of the downs, because it's the attitude, it's the way we approach it that is really the factor of kind of like inspiration, motivation. Look, things are tough, but if you approach it in a way where this is like a bummer, well, so what? You know, get your big girl panties on or the generic panties, and you go out and deal with it. And so for me, yes, we were 700 stores and we got caught in what we call the demalling of America, and where the anchors were closing and there was the Mrs. Fields cookie store, and it was basically us and the other people that brought customers. I mean, the other companies that brought customers into the mall, they were closing. Department stores were closing. So we got caught up in that. That impacted our ability to basically thrive. And yes, there were investors that came in and they repositioned so that they wanted to take control. And for me, I like to be in charge.
Sure.
So yes, there was reshuffling of the deck. They wanted me to be the figurehead. And frankly, when they started playing with the recipe and removing the butter because they didn't think the consumer would notice, I'm like, I cannot sell a product I do not believe in. So I extracted myself. And yes, it was very hard to do that. But at the same time, I had to also make a commitment. When I had that loan at 21%, everyone got paid back. Okay. It meant that I still owned the company, but in a smaller percentage. Once I was told, though, that I was being defined by kind of redirecting a recipe that I didn't believe in, I just couldn't stay. But that also gave me a chance to find new beginnings. And that led me into a whole different world, which was creating cookbooks, TV shows, motivational speaking. So yes, it was hard, but at the same time, life is not staying stale. You know, grand opening day in my mind was every day. You have got to recreate yourself and be thrilled about it because there's so much more out there to do and to learn.
That's great. We don't have to get personal about specifically about your families, but you were both raised in relatively austere environment, and you've achieved very high levels of success, and you've raised kids in affluent environments. How do you do that and instill good values and a work ethic?
A friend of mine named Rick DeSoto taught me early on with his kids, I saw it with his kids, that to take my kids out, which I did at a very early age, and I would have them sell Krispy Kreme donuts every Saturday morning. So I have three children.
And Bibles or just donuts?
Just the donuts, Krispy Kreme donuts. And so we would go on a Saturday morning. I'd get them up at 5 a.m. And they didn't like that part either. And we would go and buy 100 dozen donuts from Krispy Kreme that we had ordered the night before, load up the Range Rover with donuts. And I would take them in Atlanta. I'd go up through Marietta there, and we would hit every car dealership, tire change in place, oil change in place. And we would be there when they opened, and I'd have them go in and sell donuts. I'd take them three dozen in at a time. So they'd try to sell all three dozen one place. You know, it taught my kids. And I would tell them that, look, you know, at the end, you know, you're going to pay for the donuts back to me. So you don't get to keep all the money. And sometimes we'd take other kids out. They'd get pretty upset that they had to pay me back for the donuts.
Do you want to sleep over at the Sheely's house? No, he's going to wake us up at 4:30 and take us to Krispy Kreme. You cruel man.
But they would have to pay me back for the donuts and pay for the gas that we burned. And then whatever was left over, if they invested it in a stock, then I would match that. And so they learned very early, you know, the process of you had to pay for the goods and the cost of goods and then, you know, saving their money. And so early on, and they got, you know, they got pretty good at it. My oldest son, who's 35 now, professor at Virginia Tech, he, I remember we pulled into a Cadillac dealership in Marietta and he took his three dozen in and came back out and he only had two dozen. I said, oh, so they bought a dozen. He was about 7 years old. And he said, yeah, Dad, they weren't going to buy anything. I said, well, what'd you do? And he said, well, I went in. They said, no, kid, we're not interested in donuts. And he said, I turned around, went to the door and I started to go out. And I said, that's too bad because my dad was thinking about buying a new Cadillac. And they said, come here, kid. We'll buy some donuts.
That's so funny.
And so it was good life lessons. My youngest son, who's in college at Arizona State now, I remember I took him out one time. He always wanted to eat the donuts before we started selling.
Of course.
I said, you had to sell, you know, all 99 dozen. And then on the last dozen, you can have those. And so sure enough, we went out and he sold all 99 dozen. It was about 11:30 in the morning. And we're driving back and I hand him his dozen donuts and he was about six or seven and he had not eaten any of his donuts yet. And we were driving under a bridge there at Sandy Springs. And he said, hey Dad, I think I just saw this homeless man, under the bridge there. I said, yeah. He said, Dad, I'd like to give my donuts to that homeless man. And I said, you sure? Cause you can eat some. He said, no, I want to give all my donuts to that homeless man. So I turned the car around and we went back and he rolled the window down. The homeless guy came over, didn't have a shirt on. And I remember Adam gave all of his donuts to the homeless man. I remember driving off and Adam said, you know, that really felt good, Dad, that I did that.
How'd that make you feel?
It actually was great because from there we started going on every week over to the homeless shelter there and he would help me feed the homeless. And he would learn so much from helping feed the homeless there from those people that it was such a great experience that I think those two things combined growing up with the kids was powerful stories because I made them work. I made them learn how to save their money, but they also learned a lot about, you know, people and how lucky they were that, you know, they had a shelter and that kind of a thing. And yeah. So it was a great experience for them. And, but yeah, I mean, even in college, my youngest son went to a private school here and when he was graduating, he said, you know, hey Dad, do I get a car? I said, well, whatever you make, I'll match it and we'll buy a car. If you have $1,000, we'll buy a $2,000 car. And he said, well, Dad, that's just not fair. All my friends at Brentwood Academy, they're getting, you know, like new Porsches and things like that. And I'd say, well, you know, maybe you should go live with them. You know, if I'm not buying you a new Porsche. He would complain and I'd match it and buy him a car. And it's hard because you want to give in, you know, you always want to give in. You want to give more than what you had growing up. And sometimes that's not the best thing to do because they become entitled or they feel like they deserve that in life without earning it. And so it is hard as a parent. It is hard to make sure that you do teach the right values versus the easy thing is just give them a new car.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
The hard part is to say, nope, you got to go work for it. And then they complain and that's not fair and all of that kind of thing. So,
Debbie, your kids had to deal with having a mom who is a public person. What lessons did you try to impart on that level?
Well, first of all, I would say I have five daughters. And the first part of the equation is I see life so positively that I'm a multiplier. And so when I decided for me that I needed and wanted and desired to create a business where I felt like I had a place to go and something that I loved to do. I mean, that was something that I needed and was willing to do whatever I had to do to make that work. And then as the company grew a year later, I also wanted a family. And the challenges, especially, were you have to make a decision. Are you going to be a businesswoman or are you going to just focus on your family? It was kind of like you're supposed to make decisions that separate the two. And I'm like, why does the world believe that if I love my business, I also love and want a family? So I'm going to multiply my love. And I would have my first daughter. I'm like, I love this. And then, of course, my second daughter. And I will say that when people ask, well, how did you do it all? I have no idea, because you do whatever it takes to make things work. And you don't ask yourself how hard it is to, like, how to go through life with no sleep. Look, challenges exist. Did I do it perfectly? Absolutely not. It's a learning experience as you're kind of going through this process. And having five girls that are always so incredibly happy and never have any negativity, that's rare. I'm just joking. But and also just their different personalities. There were, you know, some wanted to be athletes, some wanted to just be on the debate team. And I didn't want to negotiate with them because I'm like, I know you're so good in what you do. Just going to take my role is the answer is either yes or no. I'm not debating this. But the kids would, I think I didn't really ever see myself as a public figure. I've always seen myself as Debbie. And Debbie, a mom, Debbie, a friend, Debbie, a businesswoman, Debbie, really interested in sports. So I have to say that I feel like the essence of me is always part of what I am to them. Now, they will say, you know, mom, you know, I wish you were there more. And I understand. Maybe I wasn't always there, but I will never, ever regret that I have never loved them more.
So just a couple more questions. I'd like to know from both of you, besides your families, what are you most proud of?
Besides the family, I'd say, you know, friendships that I've created over the years. I have a lot of acquaintances from just business and life and things, but I have some great friendships, you know, and it's the friendships that have carried me through. And I've had some hard times, you know, as well as not necessarily hard times in business as much as just, you know, things in life. And we all do. Everybody has friends. I have a friend right now that's going through a really tragic situation with the loss of his granddaughter. And so we all go through hard times, but having great friendships around you is what helps pull you through those. And I had a bad accident about 2.5 years ago. One of my horses that I was on at my farm reared up and fell back on top of me and broke my pelvis in 6 places. Wow. And then broke the arteries for all my blood. So I actually bled out all my blood by the time they got me to Vanderbilt. And so should have died. And for some reason I didn't. And the people at Vanderbilt kept me alive and put me back together. But I was bedridden for quite a while. And, you know, Debbie was there by my side, along with a lot of my friends. They said, hey, you know, you need to hire people to come in, take care of you 24/7 around the clock, you know, because you can't move. And we decided not to. All my friends showed up and took that responsibility and took care of me. So, you know, yeah. Friendships, we all go through tough times. And it's our friendships that I think are one of the most important things outside of our family, more so than business or success, is I think the friendships that you create during life.
I think you really nailed it on that. When you asked me the question, what am I most proud of besides my family and the luck I have been given in life? I would say that I feel so good about being a really loyal friend. So if you need me, like I'm not a good maintenance friend. I don't call every day, but if someone needs me, I will absolutely be the one that you want to be on your team to get you through any challenge, because I think that it's just, that is what I'm most proud of, is that you can count on me to come through during the most difficult times and get you through it.
And her phone number is 978.
I love being a loyal friend.
All right, last question. What is your favorite kind of cookie?
If you say Oreo.
My favorite is anything that Debbie makes.
Which flavor of what Debbie makes?
You know, sometimes we get creative and we make new ones that she never did. And I think I came up with a pretty good one time. I can't remember what it was, but it was just a lot of stuff we had in the cabinet. But, but you know, the bad part about it is Debbie's always making cookies for everybody. And then she always leaves some and says, these are for you to test. Mm. And she'll leave like four or five out. And I hate it because I eat all of them. She still makes a lot of cookies. We don't sell them, but she gives a lot of cookies away. That's her thing with people is I'll take them cookies.
And I have to say, when you ask me the question, what's my favorite? That's all past tense. I am always like, I don't know what I don't know. So I'm like, ooh, I wonder if this would taste good and throw it in.
Anything interesting that you've discovered that you've run across lately that you thought was exciting?
Well, I made that wine.
Oh, ooh.
I made this incredible wine brownie.
Mm. We did a cooking class during COVID with some friends of mine are the Rob and Lydia Mondavi. Rob Jr., the grandson of Robert Mondavi.
Sure.
And they live out in Napa, and they're friends of mine, and they're members in our club. And so we had 70 people on a Zoom call, and we spent 2 hours cooking and doing wine. And Debbie was in charge of the dessert. So we took wine and made brownies with the wine, which was to die for, actually. Oh. We'd never done that.
That sounds fun. Debbie, do you have an Instagram or anything you want people to follow you on? And Wade, tell me about Third Home. Where they can follow you on Third Home.
So Debbie doesn't really do a lot of the social media. I post a little bit on our Facebook occasionally for us personally, but we do have thirdhome.com is the Third Home website. We have Facebook Third Home, Instagram Third Home, and I don't know all the stuff because I don't handle that part of it for us, but I think we're on Instagram. If somebody Googles thirdhome.com, and it has all of our social media on there.
Hey, well, thank you all for your time. This is a really fun conversation, and best of luck with all you do.
Thank you.
We enjoyed it, Paul.
We really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much to Wade and Debbie for taking the time to chat. You never know what you're going to get when you talk to individuals. That was a very personal discussion. I appreciate them being candid, them sharing insights into what's made them successful. I want to say thank you to Bano Ansley, residential real estate magnate of Atlanta, Georgia, for introducing me to his friends, trusting me with his network. Thanks, bud. Let's talk about what we learned in this conversation. Number one, I loved what Wade was talking about, controlling your own thoughts. You can control your own thoughts and still be successful. Sorry, I meant that the other way around. You can control your own thoughts and still not achieve success. You can do everything in your power to be positive and still not get there. That is true. But I don't think you can really be as successful as these two are and as some of the most successful people out there are without being able to control your own thoughts. And it is the will to be positive. It is the will to see through obstacles that would stop other people in their tracks. It is that will that separates moderate achievement, at least in terms of this part of life, from significant achievement. And there is an awful lot of negative thinking in the world right now. I think if more people did what it took to get themselves into a positive mindset, you'd see them achieving more and being more self-reliant. Love to see that in the world. How to motivate yourself. It does sound crazy to sing yourself a little song in the morning, but you do what it takes. I try to start every morning just by putting my feet on the ground and saying, I am grateful that I am here. I am grateful that today is a good day and that I am alive. Just what Debbie said. Kind of interesting, isn't it? Lastly, know your values, whether that's being committed to high quality baking goods or teaching your kids the value of hard work. As Wade's hilarious donut story tells us, it takes effort to stick to your values. And sometimes you pay a price for sticking to those values, but you will always be able to have those values. And you will know who you are if you know your values and you stick to them. That's it for this week. I want to say thank you very much to everybody who came to Washington, D.C., to the D.C. Comedy Loft, and its great staff. It's a fun club. Little room downstairs where we got to do our thing, and a big room upstairs where Matthew Broussard was performing this weekend. It just was a lot of fun, and I was happy to be there, and it was heartwarming to see so many old friends. All the way back to St. Jude Elementary School, Tom Lacey showed up. Half of the Lacey twins, Tom and Robert. Tom Lacey makes his presence known in D.C. Thanks for coming out, Tom. All the Rhodes College people who came out, the Tuck 96 crew who came out, the Yahoos who came out. Where were you, St. Pius? Where were you, Facebook? Y'all come out next time. Hope to see you on the road. Shoot me an email. Tell me how your life's going. Paul@crazymoneypodcast.com. We'll be back next week with my conversation with podcaster extraordinaire Jordan Harbinger. Looking forward to that. In the meantime, Mike Carano, make me sound smart.